This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, we are kicking off Black History Month by heading to the skies, or at least bringing you a story about somebody who did. He's a young man who went from playing flight simulator on his computer to becoming the youngest man to fly solo around the world. He will tell us how and why he did this in just a few minutes. But first, we want to get the latest on the political news making headlines this week, in particular, the debate over gun control to the new faces in the U.S. Senate. Joining us to give us their thoughts are two of our trusted political observers. Kelly Goff is a political correspondent for TheRoot.com, and Ron Christie is a Republican strategist and a former aide to President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. Welcome back to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Always a
pleasure.
Great
to be back.
So let's start with the gun control debate. Kelly, we keep hearing uphill fight in Congress, uphill fight in Congress to get anything passed. So President Obama's going on the road to make the case today. He's in Minnesota meeting with law enforcement officials there to talk about his proposals to curb gun violence. I wanted to ask, how effective do you think this campaign-style approach will be in moving votes on this issue?
Well, probably not as effective as the NRA's appearances in the media. And to be clear, I don't mean that the NRA's appearances in the media are being effective strategy for those who oppose gun control. I think they're actually helping those who support gun control. I think that every time that Wayne LaPierre, the head of the NRA spokesperson who goes on the air and puts his foot in his mouth, I think that the what was once seen as a completely unrealistic possibility becomes ever more possible, which is the likelihood of actually getting some of these gun control measures like the assault weapons ban passed. And
okay.
I'll give you a quick instance, Chris Wallace.
Let me stop. Okay, I have that clip. So let me play that clip, and then you can talk a little bit more about it. Here it is for people who missed it. Here it is.
The point of that ad was this. It wasn't picking on the president's kids.
It mentions them.
The president's kids are safe, and we're all thankful for it. The point of that
They also face a threat that most children do not face.
Tell that to the people of Newtown. Tell that to people.
You really think that the president's children are the same kind of target as every school child in America?
I think
that's ridiculous, and you know it, sir.
He's talking about this ad that the NRA put up very shortly after the Newtown shooting that suggested, that asked why the president's children had armed security at school and other American kids did not. So, Kelly, you're saying that that's just not helpful.
It's not the only interview that he's done that hasn't been helpful. And it's not the only interview that anyone who opposes gun control, who is considered a spokesperson, we all know the infamous Piers Morgan interview, that has simply not been helpful. And so I'm seeing sort of a tonal shift, Michelle, where it's sort of like there are people who started saying, look, we have the Second Amendment, I have the right to my arms, the government better stay out of my business. And then it's a little bit like what happened with the healthcare debate, where people who may have been on the fence start thinking, you know, I wasn't sure I was with the president, but I know I'm not kind of with the crazies, like the people who are ripping up the Rosa Parks posters during the healthcare debate. And if you can get enough of those people who are like, I'm not sure where I am, but I know I don't want to be associated with crazy to agree, that can sometimes be enough. And I kind of sense that that's what's happening in this debate.
Okay. Let's ask Ron about this. And I just to Kelly's point, there was also another ad which actually aired during the Super Bowl, only in limited markets, it has to be said, but which was funded by a foundation that New York City Mayor Bloomberg supports, that showed footage of the same Wayne LaPierre of the NRA on the record saying he supported universal background checks for gun purchases in 1999. But then for some reason now he's against it now. So Ron, I'm going to ask you this, particularly as a person who once worked in the executive branch. Going back to the question about the president, you know, you always hear about particularly people in the executive branch saying they're going over the heads of the Congress. They're going over the heads of the media. They're taking their case directly to the people. Has that ever worked?
Well, I think it has, although I don't think it's worked for the last two administrations. I think President Bush, immediately after his reelection, went to the American people to try to sell his Social Security reform in a campaign-style manner, and it didn't work. And I think President Obama is similarly going out on the road with his campaign-style events dealing with gun control. I don't think that's ultimately going to work. Let me go back to something that Kelly said a second ago. I'm a huge fan of the NRA. I believe in their mission. I believe what they're doing, although Wayne LaPierre has to be the wrong messenger for this fight. The president's kids are off limits. The president's kids should be off limits. The president's children should have nothing to do with this political discourse that we're having on controlling certain types of firearms and ammunition. And for him to bring the first family into this, I think is so outrageous. And for those of us who are conservatives, you need to stand up and say, what's right is right and what's wrong is wrong. And what he did was wrong. I think it shifted the debate. And I think, it's reprehensible to try to bring the president's kids. And I'm glad that Chris Wallace shut him down the other way.
Now, look about that other, the other ad I was talking about. The Mayors Against Illegal Guns debuted this ad during the Super Bowl this weekend. Once again, played only in Washington, D.C., but obviously people like us are playing it again for people who didn't hear it. Let me just play a short clip, and then Ron, I'll ask you about that.
The NRA once supported background checks.
We think it's reasonable to provide mandatory instant criminal background checks for every sale at every gun show. No loopholes anywhere for anyone.
America can do this for us. Please.
Ron, what about that?
I think it's a very powerful ad. I believe in Mayor Bloomberg's First Amendment right to speech. It seems like he's got an opinion on just about everything and how to regulate everyone's lives. But who is not in favor of a universal background check? I mean, again,
NRA.
Yeah, exactly.
Today.
I am in
as
favor.
As opposed to in 1990.
Yeah, I'm in favor of the Second Amendment. But you reach a certain point where if we can keep the weapons out of people who should not have them, be it a criminal background or some other blip on their record, why wouldn't you be in favor of that? That position to me doesn't make sense.
Kelly Goff, game changer or not? Because I have to be honest, I'd completely forgotten about that testimony, which I know I saw.
So. Right. Well, I actually think that this ad is less of a game changer than, again, the foot and mouth disease of the ad attacking the First Family, which, you know, Ron reacted strongly to, like a lot of other conservatives I've heard. Because what I think is happening, Michelle, is, look, I've said this before on your show and I'll say it again. There is not a single American who does not support, including gun owners, and I'm from Texas, who supports some form of gun control, right? You ask them, do you think Osama bin Laden, after the World Trade Center attack, should have been able to walk into a store and say, I'd like to purchase a bunch of firearms today? And there's not a single American who would say yes. The question has always been, how much? And the problem is, people like Wayne LaPierre, when they release the ad attacking the Obama kids, is that they take people who might have been open to their argument and they push them further in the president's camp. So I actually think that ad might have been more effective in winning gun control support than the NRA had hoped.
We're talking with Kelly Goff and Ron Christie. We're talking about the gun control debate and other political news of the week. Just very briefly, the White House, Ron, I'll ask you this, attempted to settle this debate about people who said, well, you don't know anything about guns, so that's where you have no credibility on this. And the White House released a photo of the president skeet shooting, and that was some time ago. This was not recent. That's what they tell us. So, Ron, good idea, bad idea, stupid idea?
It's a stupid idea.
Because?
Look, you know, for having worked in the White House, you always want to manage the message. And the message is putting the president, obviously, and his policies out in the best foot forward. Digging up some obscure shot of the president skeet shooting and then juxtaposing that with the president saying he skeet shoots all the time seems to be a conflicting message. No one's ever heard of him out shooting around Camp David. He doesn't even like going to Camp David. So now we're talking about the president in this photo as opposed to the president and the policies he's seeking to advocate with gun control. I think it was a mixed message and one that they stepped on.
Well, okay, so let's just briefly, in the time that we have left, there's a new senator on the Hill this week. William Mo Cowan was selected by Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick to replace John Kerry, who's taken over Secretary of State. That means we now have two African-American senators joining. He's joining Tim Scott, who was also appointed to his seat in South Carolina. So, Kelly, very briefly, because I want to hear from both of you on this, how significant is it that we now, I think for the first time in history, have two African-American senators serving at once?
Two at once. It obviously would be more exciting when we can actually elect two African-American senators at once. But this shouldn't be, you know, undervalued. It's a momentous occasion. I had a chance to interview Michael Goldman, a political consultant out of Boston who's worked with Mo. And to me, the most exciting thing he said about this is that Governor Patrick has always been someone who wants to help create future generations of black leadership. And that's what to me is significant, is that Mo's very young. He's 43. So that's what I think is really cool about this, and looking forward to seeing what both of them do.
You know, this is something, Ron, I have to say, that isn't this something that conservatives have been good at for a long time, is looking down, you know, playing the long ball, trying to invest in people early in their career so that they have a chance to be effective over the long term. And I wonder if you see this in the same light. And I also have to ask, to Kelly's point, does it diminish the achievement in any way that these are both two appointed individuals? And the fact that Tim Scott isn't terribly interested in associating with or identifying with, you know, the African-American experience per se. He explicitly declined to join the Black Caucus, for example. Does any of that matter?
Yes, it does. Let me unpack this a little bit. I think it's a historic opportunity. their votes count as much as any other member of the Senate casting a ballot. And it is great to inspire the young people to see that you have a president of the United States who is sitting at one end of Pennsylvania Avenue, and you have two African-American senators who are on the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue. I think it's fantastic. I think that what you're going to find is that Republicans do play the long ball. We are seeding the field. I think Tim Scott will win election in his own right in the Senate, and I hope that we have other African-Americans on both sides of the political aisle who run and win office. I think it's very important for this country to have the diversity of not only our citizens, but of people of different ethnicities.
It's particularly important that they are to represent the two major political parties. Do you feel that that's something particularly important kind of as a message? The fact that they're not elected doesn't
It doesn't diminish it
diminish
to me.
It, to you.
It doesn't diminish it to me in the short term, but over the long term, I think we would all agree that both parties need to do a better job of recruiting candidates of color and, of course, giving them the opportunities to run and win.
Do you know Tim Scott?
I don't know him very well. We've met two or three times.
I mean, does it diminish the effectiveness? And you can say what you will about Alan West, who's served one term in the Congress from Florida, but he said he was explicitly joining the Black Caucus because he wanted to stand up for an alternate vision and perspective that he wanted to be associated with being African-American. And I just have to say, if a person isn't willing to affiliate in the way, for whatever reasons, perfectly reasonable ones, does that diminish the importance of that?
I don't think it diminishes the importance of it. I think the important thing is that if you want to try to change things, you need to do it from the inside. Martha Fudge, the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, is someone who I know. She's a fantastic leader. Why not join the caucus? Why not put your conservative ideology out there and allow people to hear a different frame of reference?
Ron Christie, here in Washington, D.C., Republican strategist, former aide to President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. Kelly Goff is a political correspondent for TheRoot.com. That's an online publication. She joined us from our bureau in New York. Welcome back again. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, millions of Americans sat down to watch the Super Bowl last night, and you can admit it. We know you wanted to see the ads. We'll be checking in with TV critic Eric Dagans about the ads that hit or missed or pushed some people's buttons, not in a good way. That's coming up. But first, today, we begin a series to observe Black History Month. And this year, we decided to speak with African Americans on the cutting edge. For our series this month, we are going to speak with innovators who have excelled in science, technology, engineering, and math, the so-called STEM fields. And we begin today with pilot and educator Barrington Irving. He set a world record in 2007 at the age of 23. He was both the youngest person and the first Black man to fly around the world alone. Here he is talking about that trip at a 2011 TED conference in Miami.
My airplane, due to a downdraft, descended from 20,000 feet to 9,200 feet. Now, two things happened in that moment. The first thing that happened was, of course, I did the right things. I added full power, was able to climb out. The second thing that happened in that moment was that I needed an extra set of underwear.
Now, at the ripe old age of 29, he has recently been recognized by National Geographic as an emerging explorer. His latest mission is building a flying classroom to give kids the experience of seeing mathematics in action. And Barrington Irving joins us now from Miami member station WLRN. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, man, I'm just so excited to be on this with you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Let's just start with the idea, and then you can talk about the inspiration to do what you did.
Didn't have
a private plane in the driveway?
Oh, no, we weren't blessed with a private plane in the driveway. We certainly came from humble beginnings. Family moved here from Jamaica at the age of 6. My introduction to aviation was actually random. My parents had a small Bible bookstore, and one day during off-season while I was playing football, this gentleman walked into the store dressed in his pilot's uniform and says to me, "Hey, son, have you ever thought about becoming a pilot?" And I immediately just said to him, "I don't think I'm smart enough to do it." And he then said to me, "Oh, you know, if I can do it, you can do it." Then I asked him how much money he made. And after he answered that question, I took an interest in aviation, and interest turned into passion. And here I am today.
That's all you needed to hear, huh?
Yeah.
Well, you know, flying can be quite expensive. No disrespect to the military, but that's one reason why a number of people join the military. But you didn't want to wait for that. In fact, you weren't even old enough to join the military at the time when you started trying to learn how to fly. How did you do it?
I saved up my lunch money and skipped out on meals. My parents didn't know this. They would kill me, but was able to buy a $40 software made by Microsoft Flight Simulator. And on that software, although it was virtual, man, I was able to fly anywhere in the world and simulate certain weather conditions. And that really kept my interest for quite some time until I graduated high school and was able to work hard and afford flight lessons.
How did you actually figure out where to go to get flight lessons?
Actually, you'll be amazed at the number of resources out there as it relates to how to get involved in flight training. For me, it's kind of funny. I'll never forget. We were just so poor, and it's kind of embarrassing to say, but I'll say it anyway. There was a company who had a free six-month magazine subscription, you know, and it really talks about aviation and different career opportunities, and I couldn't afford, you know, anything beyond 6 months. So the first 6 months, my name was Barrington Irving, and then the next 6 months, it was Irving Barrington, and then 6 months after that, it was something else. But, you know, I was just hungry, you know. I was hungry to learn, and I was willing to work hard.
How did the idea of flying solo around the world take hold?
When I turned 21 years of age as a black man, that really meant something to me. And I'll never forget asking myself the question, what's one thing I can do, whether I live or die, that would be worth something? And I'll never forget the idea hit me of, you know, what if I did a flight around the world? And the idea was great, but the next 2.5 years, I faced rejection after rejection. And my mental perspective, honestly, was, what do I have to lose? I have plenty of friends who didn't make it, or they got locked up. It's kind of interesting, you know, and to this day and age, I wear a brown flight suit, and I've seen others in brown suits, you know, that says Miami-Dade County Corrections Department. So it's, for me, in wanting to fly around the world, it was just solely to inspire others.
The fact is, it took you, you know, 2.5 years. You faced more than 50 rejections for sponsorships before you were finally able to convince several manufacturers to donate individual components. You took off, if I have this right, I'm just hard to envision, because I'm a mother too, and I'm thinking how I would feel if this was my son. No weather radar, no de-icing system, and $30 in your pocket.
Yep.
And when you landed, what did you see?
I come back and land, and I just literally see thousands of people at the airport waving banners and signs and congratulating me. And even the ones who tried to discourage me, or I knew they were expecting me to come back in a casket, fighting to shake my hand and to congratulate me. But what stuck out to me even more was just the amount of students that we had following me online and blogging with me, which was over 300,000 kids. And, you know, I'll never forget that moment when I departed out of Miami. I only had $30 in my pocket, and I'm reading banners and signs that says, "Go, Barrington, go." And I'm wondering to myself, where am I going? I only have $30 in my pocket. But sure enough, by the time I made my first stop, Miami fundraised close to $100,000. And the further I kept on going, the more money was raised.
Well, what are you up to now? What are you trying to do now? You've got a number of educational programs that you are involved in. Tell me a little bit about those.
Yeah, so the past few years for me since flying around the world has certainly been interesting. I've pretty much transitioned from being a pilot to also becoming an educator. And one of the first projects I tested was our Build and Soar program, where we challenged 60 kids from failing high schools in Miami to build an aircraft from scratch, and not only build it from scratch, but put my life on the line to fly it for its first flight. A number of those students have gone on to college. A number of them have gotten degrees in various fields. I mean, there's one young lady, Bakari, who at the time of that project, she couldn't point out a 16th of an inch on a ruler, and now she is on a full scholarship as a math major at Duke University.
Tell me about the flying classroom.
We're creating a real-life magic school bus by transforming a $5 million private aircraft donated by the Beechcraft Corporation into the world's first flying classroom. So what does that mean?
Well, hold on. For people who aren't familiar with, who don't have kids, the Magic School Bus is a series of books where the school bus magically takes kids on all kinds of adventures where they understand, you know, things like the rainforest, the core of the earth, the environment, stuff like that. And then, and this is a real life one.
Yep. Now we've figured out a way to do it in real life where we will utilize this flying aircraft and be able to not only communicate with classrooms from the air, but we're traveling all seven continents where we'll conduct various expeditions. Could be around geothermal energy, biodiversity, innovations in technology. But we're doing it in a way where students actually control the results of every mission, from the meals I eat to the experiments that's conducted and the data and research that's collected. It's all done by the students virtually, and I'm just fulfilling the actions that they choose.
And when will this start?
This will start September of 2014, and we're just very excited to be able to collaborate with so many individuals and corporations to create Classroom in the Sky.
What do you think this means? What do you think is the lesson here?
It's interesting because the problem that we face in this country as it relates to STEMs, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math, is a national problem. We need as many bodies that we can find to become the next leaders in those areas. And I found working with all types of students, this nation faces an even bigger problem. Our problem is the students of today are simply unmotivated, regardless of background or economic status. And I think what we're doing in education, we want to be the best, but we're afraid to challenge our kids to be the best. And that's where I put forth with action with some of the projects that we're doing. I don't say we're going to do something and expect our students to fail. Failure certainly isn't an option. Whether it's building a plane or having kids as young as 8 years old, building a car faster than a Ferrari, we have to put tangible challenges with real finish lines in front of these kids' faces. Because when a child has the opportunity to do those types of projects or anything hands-on or skills-based, they're not looking at, oh, I have to learn the math and science and algebra and chemistry and physics and so forth behind doing some of these things. They're looking at the finish line.
Barrington Irving is a pilot and educator who set a world record as the youngest person and the first black man to fly around the world alone. He spoke with us from WLRN in Miami. Barrington Irving, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations. And we can't wait to see what you do next.
All right. Take
Bye.
Care.
Switching gears now. Last night's Super Bowl featured three stunners, a 35-minute blackout, Beyonce, if you don't mind my saying so, and a thrilling comeback that came up short. Oh, yeah, the score. The Ravens beat the 49ers 34-31. But for some fans, and I think it's okay to admit this, the high points of the game include the commercials, which cost about $4 million for a 30-second spot. So let's talk about them with Eric Dagans, TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times. Eric, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Michelle, thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the commercial that I think, in, even before the game, was getting a lot of buzz. Not just the good kind. It was a spot from Volkswagen, and it features a white office worker who speaks with a Jamaican accent. Here's a clip.
Hey, Dave, you're from Minnesota, right?
Yes, I. The land of 10,000 lakes. The Gopher State.
So in conclusion, things are pretty dismal.
You know what this room needs? A smile. Who want to come with I?
So, Eric, you were a fan. I want to hear why. Just to explain to people that the premise of it, in case they didn't see it, which is that the Volkswagen makes you so happy. I guess it's what? That the Volkswagen makes you so happy that you speak with a Jamaican accent? Is that it?
I was not a fan of this.
You were not
commercial.
A fan of this. Okay,
yeah,
tell
I want
me.
To be clear about that. I was
okay,
a little
I
troubled
hear
by it.
It,
actually, because... And I got a lot of pushback from readers of my blog and people who follow me on Twitter and Facebook, particularly when I brought this up when it aired during the Super Bowl last night. But what it comes down to me is the humor in the ad comes from a white guy who sounds like he's talking in a way that we mostly imagine black Jamaicans talking. There are white Jamaicans who sound like that, but I think, you know, in our cultural consciousness, we don't often think about white people sounding like that. We picture black guys with dreads who play in reggae bands or something. And it just seemed – it felt odd. It felt weird. It wasn't quite – like I wouldn't use the word racist. I wouldn't go that far. I would just say that it made me uncomfortable. And
do you know why it made you uncomfortable?
Because, like I said, the humor in the ad comes from a white guy adopting a black accent.
Well, can I try?
And we've seen other. I mean, because the portrayal is positive, because he's portraying somebody who's upbeat and fun and bringing light to a dismal situation, people are cool with it. But if he was doing that and he was doing something negative, then people would have a hard time with it. But I'm wondering if the act itself is something we should be concerned about.
Well, I'm told that the Jamaican Tourism Office does like the ad. But what I think, if you don't mind my trying my hand at it, is I think that what's troubling about it is the implication that all Jamaicans are happy.
Yeah, yeah.
And well, it's almost like it kind of plays into this forgive me folks, the happy darky myth, the sort of stereotype that just you're happy just all the time. And well, why would you be? No human being is happy. No group of people is happy all the time. And it's also appropriated because Volkswagen is not a Jamaican company. So you kind of feel like, so I don't know. It's interesting
that's the other half of what troubles me about it is it's connected to a stereotype. It's a white guy who is evoking a black stereotype by talking like a black person. And that is what troubled me about it. But I sort of agree with comic W. Kamau Bell, who sort of said, you know, on the list of racist stuff, it's like maybe number 3,000. You know,
okay.
It's way down on the list. But it is something that troubled me. And what troubled me more about it is that it was hard to talk about the nuances of the situation without people getting so upset You can't say this ad troubles me without calling Volkswagen like an incredibly bigoted company.
Oh, I don't think you did that.
Which nobody was saying.
I want to turn to the other commercial that you wanted to flag for us. This is one of the other ones that people are talking about. It's the Dodge Ram truck commercial, and it features a monologue from the late radio broadcaster Paul Harvey. Here's a clip.
God said I need somebody willing to get up before dawn, milk cows, work all day in the fields, milk cows again, eat supper, then go to town and stay past midnight at a meeting of the school board. So God made a farmer.
What do you think about this ad resonated with people?
I think it was the connection to sort of traditional values and the fact that it was so simple. We were bombarded by all these ads that had tons of CGI and all kinds of babies flying through space and all kinds of craziness. But the ad that was one of the most effective was just a really effective radio communicator telling this this story just laden with traditional values that people, I think, still kind of yearn for in this time. And so you know, not a lot of people, I think, knew who Paul Harvey was online. You know, a lot of younger people didn't know who he was. They just knew that they were transfixed by this voice.
And we only have a minute left. So, Eric, sure. So is there one overarching theme this year, one takeaway from what we saw this year?
You know, it's the message that always comes through Super Bowl ads, which is that creativity and having your finger on the pulse of society always trumps the gimmicks. So, you know, the Viva Young ad that Taco Bell did with old folks going out and partying the way the young people do, that really touched people in a way that a lot of these much more highly produced ads really didn't do.
Did it make you want to go get a Taco Bell?
You know, I wonder if I would live to be that age if I ate Taco Bell. But it was an effective ad, and it made me think. It made me think well of the brand, even though I wouldn't necessarily eat there.
Okay, well, thank you. Eric Dagans is the TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times, with us once again from their newsroom. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Singer-songwriter Angélique Kidjo was born in Benin, West Africa. Today she lives in New York and is widely considered Africa's greatest living diva. Music gave Kidjo the power to move people. Hers packs a punch with its rhythm and its message. She earned her first Grammy nomination in 1994 for the hit Agolo. It's a plea to protect the environment. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Take back, baby, if I feel like Papa.
Ashley Kijo also uses her voice to speak for those who cannot. She's been a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador for a decade. She set up an organization, the Batonga Foundation, to help girls achieve a secondary education in Africa. And Forbes magazine lists her as one of the most powerful celebrities in Africa. With all that going on, we were very happy to find that she was willing to take a break from her concert tour. She stopped in Washington, D.C., and she was nice enough to come by our Washington, D.C. studios. Anjali Kijo, welcome back to the program. Thank you so much for
joining
us.
Thanks for having me back. I haven't been here in a while, and I was missing it.
Well, thank you for that. You know, there's a song that goes by the same name as your foundation, so let's listen to that, and you can tell us a little bit more. Translation. Do you want to translate?
Well, this song is a song that is talking about how you can empower yourself through education and through who you are. It's talking about the story of a young girl that comes from a very poor background that happened to have a light skin color and very intelligent. And they will not let her have access to education. And she celebrates her beauty. She celebrates herself. And Batonga pretty much was the word that I invented when I was going to school. I was in high school. It was my mantra to turn boys away from me because they taunt you. At one point, you can go to school to a certain level, and as soon as you're reaching the point where you can get to university and transform your life and become a leader in your own right, there's many different words, stuff that are said to just make you feel so bad that you don't want to go back to school, or you just want to avoid the trouble. And I remember vividly my father telling me, you can't get into a fight, because I was complaining. And he always said to me, your ultimate weapon is your brain. Mm-hmm. It has no color. It has no frontier. Use it. Be creative. Find something that will baffle the intelligence, that will try to find an answer to it that means nothing to them, but to you means a lot. That empower you to continue going to school and do what you have to do. That's when I come up with that word, Batonga. And also, I call my foundation Batonga because I want to give them that mantra. I want them to have wings. That's why the logo is a butterfly. I want the metamorphosis. I want those girls that come from a very poor background to dream big and to make that dream happen through education. We can only empower our women in Africa, our young girl, to transform Africa, because that's what we need to create democracy, to create a fair and just society. We need people to educate it. That's the key for everything.
Well, to that end, though, I mean, your foundation is working in 5 countries in Africa, but one that's been in the news recently is Mali. And there was this movement in Mali that is kind of an Islamic fundamentalist initiative has taken place by force of arms. What are you hearing from your sources there about particularly how women and girls are being affected by this?
Well, the news is not really good for the women. I mean, the girls that I supported in Kidal have no news since this conflict started. And it's kind of a worry for me. I mean, there's no day that goes by without me thinking about those girls, because every year, even before this conflict, Kidal was already a very fragile place. And I remember every year they would send me messages through USAID that support me and that program in Mali, telling me, don't give up. We dodge the bullet. We go to school. Don't withdraw on us. I've really respected the courage of those girls. Today we have France intervening. And I hope that intervention won't last long.
And the African Union.
And the African Union. I just hope that those intervention won't linger on and become a conflict like in Iraq or in Afghanistan, that the regular army in Mali will be helped logistically for them to be able to take over and create the rule of law in their own country. I want that to happen. But before we do that, we need to go through this process, which is a really painful one. And the women are the first victim. Because one of the things that those fundamentalists did were they installed the Sharia law. So religion becomes an excuse for those people to commit horrible crime. Why do we have that? Because the unfairness of this world. We need justice and fairness and freedom for every single human being, not only in America, but around the world.
We're speaking with a singer, songwriter, humanitarian, Angelique Kijo. She was kind enough to stop by our Washington, D.C. studios while she's on tour. We were talking about the toll that this I don't know what you want to call it, insurgency is taking on girls and women in Mali, but it's also taking a terrible toll on musical artists there, particularly.
Absolutely.
You know, music has essentially been banned. We're hearing reports that many people have had their instruments destroyed. I just was hoping that you could describe, as an artist, a little bit about Mali's rich musical history. I think people will have heard the music even if they don't know the names, but there are some very famous musicians who've come from Mali, like the late Ali Farkat Touré or Salif Keita or Atumani
Diabaté.
And so could you just describe a little bit for people of why it's so important that these artists are being denied or the opportunity to do their music there?
You know, one thing that I realized when I was living in Benin, when the communist regime arrived, the first thing they banned from radio and TV was the music. I mean, not only the music from the Beninese artists, but the music of America, of England, of France. The whole world's music was banned. Why? Because through music, people can find strength in themselves and say, this is not right. Music, what it does, it represents the country positively. We are the ambassadors of our country and our cultures. And that is something they don't want to. When they shut the music down, they bring darkness. I don't see any society that can live without music. Music is part of our history in Africa. We have griot in Mali. They are the ones that keep on telling us the story of our ancestor till today and how we as musicians, we are impacting this music for the next generation. If you take that away, it means that the next generation, if they succeed, the next generation won't have no knowledge about Ali Farka Touré, about Salif Keita, about any other music in the world. Mali is the cradle of blues. Everybody knows that. And what makes blues so important is because it helped also on the other side of Africa, slaves, to keep the dignity of human being. Music help everybody to stand tall in their shoes, and they will take you on. And that they don't want strong people. Fear, when you install fear somewhere, you take everything that gives people the strength to regroup themselves and to come back and say, I'm not listening to you, and I don't care if you kill me. Music gives you the power to stand for it.
You wrote a piece for the New York Times opinion pages back in November, and you said that music is more powerful than the spoken word, quote, because when someone sings, truth speaks directly to your heart, which is also pretty powerful coming from someone like you who speaks, what, five languages?
More than that,
five, six, seven. I've kind of lost count. But what would you urge the musicians in Mali to do now? What should they do?
They should just be in resistance and continue doing their music, no matter what. If they have to leave the country for a while to continue being the voice of the country, for their country not to be forgotten, for people to pay attention, we can do that for music. Because music talk to everybody. Talk to the common person in the street that doesn't know anything. Then people are going to start looking at the geography of Mali and see how it is intertwined with Libya, with all West Africa. That is a danger today of peace, because you have Boko Haram from Nigeria joining this. And they are killing Christians every day because the world goes silent. Who can speak for the one that are dying today if it's not us musicians? That have no political tie to anybody.
So you're saying that they should find a way to keep the music alive, even if it means leaving, even if it means living in exile for a while, that the music has to survive. Do you ever personally feel torn between your desire just to create music just for your own pleasure and for the pleasure of the listener and for your, you can hear it in your voice, your intense need and desire to speak about the very pressing things that are going on in the world. Do you ever feel those things in conflict?
No, because those two things are part of my stability. Because they are songs that I write for just the pleasure of singing them. Because I need that. I mean, no human being have endless compassion. You need to replenish yourself. And I know that if I didn't have music, I'd go crazy. Not only because of the situation, but also what I see on the field as a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador. When you're facing a girl of 16 years old that has been raped constantly, that can't speak, and all her demeanor, the way she holds herself, is just pain from head to toe. And you look at that eyes, you don't know what to do. And the only thing that gives you a glimpse of smile is songs, when you start singing, because it brings her back to her childhood. It brings her back to good memory. And that's the power of music. Same thing happened with a child soldier. It's just like music is such deep, engraved deeply in our DNA to free us, to get the goodness out of us. That's why the extremists just want to get rid of it. and art in general, not only music, poetry, art, drawing, sculpture, everything. Look at the Taliban in Afghanistan and in different places. They just take every piece of art out. And look what they did in Tombuktu. I mean, why? Because it represents something that is universal, that everybody can come around and try to trace back your roots out of that. Because in every piece, in every place, there is a little bit of us, because we all come from Africa. That's what music said, and that's what I sing too sometimes. I don't only sing about all the frustration, I also sing about positive story of people. I always also sing about the flamboyance and the beauty of my continent. The women of Africa, they are my backbone. They really inspired me, because in every difficult situation, they always rise. When I walk in the market and a woman comes to me and says, thanks for what you're doing for us. Thanks for speaking for us. Thanks for representing us. We see the future differently. We put in our kids to school. Why? Because I speak to you, because I sing, because I have been at one moment the voice that needed to say what they have to say that they couldn't say at that time. That for me alone, it means the world to me.
Speaking of singing, we were able to catch up with you, as I mentioned, while you are on tour with the great Diane Reeves and the
Liz
great
Wright.
Liz Wright.
Yeah, absolutely.
The tour is called Sing the Truth. Come together.
Well, we started this tour in 2009, I think, and we were paying tribute to Nina Simone, because her repertoire is vast, and also her story is important for us to tell, because when you are a woman in this business, it is hard, and on top of it, when you're a black woman, it's even harder. And people like Miriam Makeba, Nina Simone, Odetta, I mean, all of those women have been there for us. They paved the way for us to be the free singers that we are today. So we decided after that first edition that we're going to open it to all different women singer-songwriters of the 20th century. So we have Annie DiFranco in the repertoire. We have Joni Mitchell. We have Etta James. We have Shirley Caesar. We have even, I mean, we have songs that tell the story positively about women. It's not only victimize us. We are not victim. If we perceive ourselves as victim, they will have won. And the question I always ask, and I'm still waiting for the answer, is what threat do we pose to men for us to be always the one that come after? Without us, there's no manhood. Without women, there's no humanhood. We give birth. Even though we need men for that, it's a relationship that have to be done in harmony. No one should be superior. We are partner in life together. You cannot disrespect the woman that gave you your children that you are proud of. If you dismiss her, you dismiss yourself. You dismiss your children.
You save a little bit of that voice for later. Well, we thank you for spending some time with us. I hear that you are at work on a new album, correct? And also a memoir. Do I have that right? A memoir, yeah, which is going to come out later in the year. Can you just give us a little hint of what we can look forward to?
The memoir, when I started this, I thought it was going to be a simple process, and I'm realizing that writing a book is much more complicated than writing a song. And I have a ghostwriter, a friend of mine, that is really taking in a lot of information. It's not easy because there are a lot to deal with. And it's not only going to talk about how my struggle from a poor family in a poor country to where I am today. It's also going to talk about issues like child labor, child trafficking, what I have witnessed, and how those things have to change. Because I cannot be happy if I know that there are children that goes to bed every day without a shelter, free meal a day, and to have access to good education and good health. And we are far away from it. And even here in America, we still need that. it means that something in our society have to be addressed differently. We have the power of change. We just have to have the courage of putting our resources and our skill to it to make sure that everything is done perfectly.
Well, we'll look forward to both of those things. Angelique Kidjo is an award-winning singer, songwriter, humanitarian, activist. She was born in Benin, and she was kind enough to take a break from her tour to join us in our studios here in Washington, D.C. Angelique Kidjo, thank you so much for joining us. Don't make it so long next time.
No, I'll try to come very quick. I have a lot of things going on, but I have to be humble here because I haven't finished yet. I can't talk too much about it. I might take a different direction, but I'm always working in music and different things for people to see the diversity of things that we can do. We are not pigeonholed, all of us.
And one more thing. Mali's musicians are rallying together. Last month, some of the country's best-known musicians, including Toumani Diabaté, who Angelique Kidjo mentioned just now, gathered in Bamako to release the song Maliko, or Peace. So let's end with that. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow. Mali de ketumboye ha le nani fodununya ma.